From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Here's what's happening. Strange story out of Phoenix. Phoenix police say that a seventh homicide and three other shootings are related to the same serial shooter or shooters believed to be responsible for six other murders in recent months. The shooting death of Crystal White, a 55-year-old, is the additional homicide now listed by police as believed to be linked. White was found dead a few months ago along a street east of downtown Phoenix after neighbors reported hearing gunshots in the area. So they've got some sickos running around there. In St. Louis, just moments ago, two people killed, one hospitalized in a shooting in South St. Louis. A St. Louis police officer was fired upon, suffered a graze wound to the leg while responding to the homicide scene. And still in St. Louis, 185,000 customers without power tonight as thunderstorms roared through the St. Louis area. Boy, I got out of there just in time, didn't I? This is a story that will really kind of choke you up, but I thought I'd tell it to you. Out of San Antonio, Texas. It's a story of two high school sweethearts who left the world the same way they lived it, together. It's a love story that spans nearly six decades. George and Oralee Rodriguez, they celebrated their 58th wedding anniversary on June 1st. The two met in San Antonio, and it was love that just never faded. Eventually, both developed dementia, and a few months ago, George suffered a stroke. On Tuesday, George passed away in his sleep. Just 3 hours later, Oralee passed away as well, surrounded by their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Isn't that an amazing story? Wow. Donald Trump's vice presidential search turned into a head-spinning melodrama as candidates vying for the spot hopped on planes and phones to perform frenzied last-minute tryouts. Trump says Friday he will close and announce who his vice presidential running mate will be. Howard Bloom has been watching the campaign for us since its inception. Howard, any guesses here?
The astonishing thing is that Donald Trump lost control of the headlines for 5 days because of the shootings in Dallas, because of the shooting in Michigan, because of the kinds of headlines you've just been giving us. And he managed to get it back today. And it's actually one of the most boring vice presidential races you've ever seen in your life, but he managed to turn it into what CNN called a head-spinning melodrama. Now, in reality, here are the people who are running. It's Mike Pence, who is the Indiana governor, and Mike Pence has a great haircut, and he's backed by the Koch brothers. The guys who put together almost $1 billion in campaign contributions to buy the White House this year. And guess who defeated them? Donald Trump. He's also backed, Mike Pence is also backed by Paul Manafort, who's managing aspects of the campaign right now for Donald Trump. Then there's Newt Gingrich, and he is supported by another of the billionaire backers, that's Sheldon Adelson. There's Chris Christie, who has been tag-teaming, who has been the buddy of Donald Trump.
Yeah, he's been the solid backbone there.
Right, exactly. And there's Michael. Now, this is an outsider. If you really want to watch for something interesting and exciting, it's Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He's a registered Democrat. He parted with Barack Obama because he didn't see eye-to-eye with Barack Obama about how to treat Islamic militancy, how to treat jihadism, and you could possibly see Donald Trump making headlines by pairing himself with a general, and that's what Michael Flynn is. But the guy who's really up front is Chris Christie. Chris Christie has skeletons in his closet, he has Bridgegate, but the fact is these are two bullies, both of them, Donald Trump and Chris Christie. They get along like Bonnie and Clyde. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Bread and butter.
They know how to double team. Yeah, they know how to double team each other. They are a buddy movie. And what Donald Trump says is that he wants somebody who understands his campaign. That means somebody who says yes to everything that Donald Trump says. And Chris Christie has demonstrated that yes man capacity to the nth degree, plus the tough guy capacity.
So your pick is?
My pick is Chris Christie. I think that's who he's going to go for. But right now, Donald Trump is on an airplane with Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, who's also on the list. So he's going to keep us in suspense until Friday.
Yeah, he's going to milk this. Thanks a lot, Howard. Appreciate it. And Howard said the shooting in Michigan, he meant Minnesota. China's spies hacked into computers at the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC. Listen to this. From 2010 until 2013, according to American government officials, and they say they tried to cover it up, according to a congressional report, the House of Representatives Science, Space, and Technology Committee released this investigative report. It presents the FDIC's bank regulators as technologically inept and deceitful. How about that? General Motors 2009 bankruptcy does not shield it from lawsuits over a deadly ignition switch defect that led to criminal charges against the automaker, prompting the recall of 2.6 million vehicles in 2014, that according to a federal appeals court. The British government has awarded feasibility study contracts to five industrial teams that want to orbit or suborbital launch vehicles from British territory on a commercial basis. So they're getting involved in the game. What else is going on in space? Let's check in with space historian Robert Zimmerman. Hey, Robert, what's going on out there?
Well, lots of things, George. Considering the miserable state of the news, there's at least I can talk about some good and some bad things. As you know, early this week, Juno went into orbit around Jupiter. I posted on Behind the Black its first orbital picture, which is a bit fuzzy because the spacecraft is quite a distance away. It won't get into its real orbit until late August, in October, and it'll get close to Jupiter in October, in August, and that's when we'll get some really good pictures, the first really good pictures. And Curiosity was out of operation for a week, and they got it working back again, and it's starting to move up Mount Sharp and Gale Crater again, and that's good. And then the bad news, the toilet on the American part of the ISS is broken. And that's interesting. They have to use the Russian bathroom on ISS right now because the U.S. one is broken. So we have some good news and some bad news right now, what can I say?
And the website, BehindTheBlack.com. Robert, thanks. Always great talking with you. The National Park Service is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year, and the folks at Gettysburg National Military Park want to remind you not to take any stones from the park. Why? Because they could be cursed. That's according to a blog post by Maria Brady, a park ranger at Gettysburg. Brady writes that the park sometimes gets packages in the mail with people returning rocks that they took, which is a violation of federal regulations. It can result in fines and levies. And she points out, though, those packages usually have letters. In one letter sent to Gettysburg in May, a man admits that he and his wife took three stones. We don't know then how the removal of these stones would affect our lives, and we don't know that they were cursed, he wrote. The man then explained that he lost his wife, his son, his job, and then went to prison. In another letter, someone suffered several surgeries, relationship failures. They all brought the stones back. And a story in the news at coasttocoastam.com, really strange picture. A chilling photo taken at the scene of a fatal motorcycle crash in Kentucky is getting a lot of attention online. Many Facebook users say the photo shows the motorcycle driver's spirit leaving his body. I don't know if this is photoshopped or not. Go and see it at In the News at coasttocoastam.com. Clearly, you can see a ghostly figure floating above the crash scene. Amazing. Up next, we're going live to Malta to talk about the world in chaos with Robert Young Pelton next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Young Pelton with us. Robert Young Pelton has become the inspiration role model for a new generation of intellectual adventurers. He is an author, a journalist, filmmaker, photographer, and indeed an adventurer as well. He has trained Navy SEALs and special forces training. He motivates young people to do all kinds of great things, and he's back on Coast to Coast, live from Malta. Robert, what are you doing out there?
I'm working with the Migrant Offshore Aid Station. We run a fleet of two ships and drones, and we're rescuing people in the Central Med that are fleeing from Libya. And if you go to moask.e, you can see what I'm up to.
Good for you. Good for you. Many people doing that? Fleeing?
Yeah, we've got a private fleet out there. You know, Medicine Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, has three ships. Groups like Sea-Watch and other groups have small ships out there. We probably have the most efficient and most professional one, but the crisis in Europe, you know, of people fleeing from wars in Syria and Africa is quite extreme, and they come across the ocean to get to Europe, and a lot of them drown. There's a 23% death rate for people that attempt to make that crossing.
Robert, the world is in chaos. I mean, it is absolutely in chaos. Are we ever going to rein it in and get it back to normal again?
Well, this is the new normal. I mean, the thing that I'm looking at, and as you know, I've spent many, many years writing books on war, and, you know, I used to round them up, and I still do, in the world's most dangerous places.
Yeah.
And my job was to go to every one of these wars, talk to the rebels, talk to the government, and figure out what they were fighting about. And what I've seen under the Obama administration is that we have pulled back from direct wars, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've begun using proxies. And you remember we did this in the 80s against the Soviets in Afghanistan and Angola.
Right.
We used mercenaries. We used the local...
The Mujahideen, right? We pushed them.
Yeah. And at the time, it seemed wonderful because they were all glorious freedom fighters and helping us do our dirty work. But those people morphed. And I'm seeing two trends here. And this is really something that people should watch, and I encourage people to discuss it. We are empowering groups that would never normally have access to a lot of weapons to fight our wars, and we're not winning those wars. And secondly, I'm predicting that whether Clinton or Trump wins the election, they will both be war presidents. And I say that because I think they will try to shore up their divisive support by getting into the wars. And Hillary has shown that she has no problem destabilizing Libya or Syria. So I think we're looking at a very different change over the next 8 years.
Is it going to backfire on us, Robert, as a nation?
Well, it is.
Already has.
You know, it has backfired on us.
We
went into Iraq with the idea that we were destabilizing a dictator, and we reversed the flow of things. We put a Shia government in power. That then alienated the Sunnis. They became the insurgency, and then as we left, they morphed into ISIS, and then you saw what happened in Syria and Iraq,
right.
And we're still fighting there.
Many of Saddam's old soldiers and military folks merely became members of ISIS, did they not?
Yeah, well, you remember Paul Bremer issued an edict which basically cut off the salaries and retirement funds for every member of the Ba'ath Party.
That's right.
Sounds very innocuous, but that was most of the country worked for the government. And obviously they had a huge military after fighting a war with Iran. So that had a cataclysmic effect on people who normally would get a little stipend every month, suddenly took up arms and began fighting.
Doctors, teachers, all of them that were part of Saddam Hussein's regime, they got ousted.
Right. And you got to remember the structure of Iraq is very much like Syria. You know, you don't just have one type of person. You have a Sunni-Shia divide, and you have many more divides in Syria. And if you look at the Anbars and the Ambaris, these were people along the river that encouraged the insurgency, and they were the ones to first embrace ISIS. So places like Fallujah and Mosul and Ramadi are areas where they invite people in to fight their wars for them, essentially using proxies just like
That's right. I remember, Robert, when we went into Iraq in March of 2003, and there was no fighting, basically. I mean, Saddam soldiers just literally took off their uniforms, put on their clothes, and walked away. And when I saw that happen, I said, oh, no, this is going to come back to haunt us in a big way. And then a few years later, we saw some of the insurgents and then the stories of the beheadings of people. That seemed to have went away, and then ISIS just kind of exploded on the map. How did that pop up all of a sudden?
Well, you have to remember that when we went into Iraq, that was the second time.
Second time, that's right.
We invaded Kuwait to push the Iraqis out. And there was a very interesting incident on television in which General Schwarzkopf and a number of Iraqi generals sat at a table and they signed a bunch of documents. Well, we knew that was the Iraqis surrendering, but the Iraqis thought that we had surrendered. And I was in Iraq and Baghdad before and during the war, and people were shocked that they had beaten America and suddenly we were at war again. They didn't believe it. And when we showed up, they weren't really anti-American. And this is something that's very funny because it was the same situation in Afghanistan. The general population was in shock, but they weren't necessarily anti-American. And when we fired everybody and put them out of the job and started to micromanage their country, then they said, well, wait a second, you were supposed to liberate us, not, you know, run us. And certain elements who used to get very large payments from Saddam, and I'm talking about the Anbar tribes and people like that, mm-hmm. suddenly had their money cut off. And so they went to other sources, and that's when the fundamentalists came.
And at this point with ISIS, you know, they control many oil fields, many prime oil fields in Iraq. How are they pumping it out? Who's doing the pumping? Who's working for them? How are they getting the oil to tankers? Who's doing that? And then where's the money going? What banks are supporting them?
Okay, so you have to remember, ISIS is essentially a bunch of lazy kids, right? They don't do anything except shoot guns. They tax things. So when they go into a town, they immediately go to the city council and say, okay, you need to pay this much money. Then they go to the local businesses.
It's like a ransom.
They go to the Yeah, and then when they go to the local oil manufacturers or oil pumpers, they say, okay, if you want to do business and you want to fill up these trucks or run these pipelines, you're going to have to pay us X amount of money. Now, there always was a smuggling business coming out of Iraq in Kurdistan. All ISIS did was tap into that, because when you have, let's say, diesel fuel in Kurdistan or in Iraq, it's much, much cheaper than the taxed European price. So there's always been a huge smuggling business. All they did was just add a tax on top of that and started to make millions of dollars. They don't physically work anywhere. They just tax people.
Now, where do they put their money, though? I mean, why can't we just seize the assets from a bank?
This is cash. This is literally people with a bag going business to business and getting paid in cash, and then they distribute those to the fighters.
U.S. dollars?
They also use, mostly U.S. dollars, but they also use hawalas. And hawala is a very ancient form of Western Union that can take money from one place. You can walk into, let's say, Dubai, you walk into a storefront, you give the man behind the counter $10,000, and you say, my buddy in Somalia, his name is Mohammed, and here's his phone number. You wait 2 or 3 minutes, and then your buddy calls you from Somalia and says, great, I got $10,000. It's literally the most efficient form of money transfer in the world, and it's all secretive.
Bizarre. And it works, obviously.
It works very, very well. Geez. And it's how terrorists and even businessmen move money around the Middle East. It's a fascinating, very efficient way to do it. And this is what terrorists use.
Why can't this stuff be broken up, Robert?
It is being broken up. Right now we have Special Forces, ODAs, and Navy SEAL teams in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Kurdistan. And what they're doing is they're training and directing our proxies to slowly push back ISIS out of town, like physically dislodging them, which removes them from that tax base, and it also cuts off their line of supplies. Our proxies don't do airstrikes very well, so we're helping them coordinate airstrikes. But this has been going on since June of 2013. So it's taken a very, very, very long time. For example, there's groups in Libya that are bombing Sirte, but it's taking a very long time to push these militias in, because what happens is that when we win, and I'll use air quotes around the word win, a war with a proxy, they begin fighting amongst themselves. So for example, in Libya, on one side of Sirte, where ISIS is, which is the western side, you have the official government, which is then signed an agreement with a giant militia called the 166. And on the other side, you have a guy named Haftar, who's working with Egypt, Russia, and the UAE, who is pushing from the east side. Now, when these people meet up, guess what they're going to do? They're going to fight over who controls Sirte. Now, we're supporting both those sides, because we don't want to bomb our own people and we want to get rid of ISIS. But you see the thing we're setting ourselves up for. You also see this in Syria.
Good point. Robert, stay with us. We're going to come back, take this quick break, and talk with you about more things with the world in chaos. Next hour, we'll open up your phones and give you an opportunity to talk with Robert Young Pelton. He's live, by the way. He's in Malta. We'll be back. Tickets going very fast now for our Asheville, North Carolina, August 27th event. So come on by. If you've been thinking about it, jump on board. They will hold back a few for walk-ins, but you can go online now and get your own seats and pick out where you want to sit. Simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. You will see at the highlight reel the Asheville, North Carolina picture and banner. Click it. Look for the tickets. Look for the date, August 27th, and get your tickets. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Robert Young Pelton with us. He is live in Malta, folks. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with him as we talk about the world in chaos. And Robert, back to this global migration issue. Is it out of control? Is it manageable? What's happening there?
Well, right now, the United Nations estimates that about 65 million people are out of their homes, and they're either in camps or they're moving. They're internally or externally displaced. And this is the highest number since World War II. And when you think of it in that scale, it's quite a large thing. Now, what does this mean? What this means is you've got two things going on that are not being resolved. One is warfare. You've got wars around the world that just keep continuing and continuing. And then you've got economic problems that are not going to be resolved. So these people are all heading towards Europe or America or affluent areas where they can get jobs. So that doesn't seem like a threat at first, but it does when you realize that these people are not staying to rebuild their countries or fight. And that creates these sort of endless cycles of violence and poverty and warfare. So are these people going to threaten the United States? No. They're usually families that need a place to live. But what happens in the place they leave? And this is why we're seeing these wars that just never, ever seem to end.
And they just walk away from everything they owned?
Well, they don't have a choice. I mean, if ISIS comes into your town and cuts people's throats, so you're not going to hang around to see if they change their mind. You're going to get out of there. And then once you're out of your home, you're essentially at the mercy of the people you run into. So you've got people traveling from Syria all the way to Germany. They don't necessarily want to do that. They'd like to go back home, but they don't have a choice. You've got people in the Gambia and Nigeria who just have nothing better to do, so they just start heading north towards Europe. Right now, it's cheaper to pay a smuggler to come to Europe than it is to fly. So these routes, which carry about a million people a year, are very efficient and they're very well run.
These 65 million people, what's the breakdown percentages in terms of men, women, children?
Well, most of these people are standard family units. I mean, the people leave en masse. When we're out at sea, we'll find the usual mixture with larger numbers of young males coming for economic reasons. So, for example, people from Syria, you know, I've been on rescues where there's a doctor, it's a lawyer, and there's his wife and his sister and his two kids. And as soon as you rescue them, they then book a hotel and buy a ferry ticket and take the train to Europe. In Africa, you're seeing hundreds and hundreds of young unemployed men who really just have no options, so they just start heading north. And these people ideally are supposed to be returned because they're economic migrants. They have no claim to stay in Europe. But the system kind of absorbs them because they need cheap labor. So it's dramatically changing many of the countries that we thought were sort of, you know, like, for example, when you go to Paris and you take three subway stops from the center, you could be in Algeria, you know, you could be in an African country because there are so many migrants. Now, once again, most of these people are not doing anything other than working, but when you have these ISIS-inspired shootings, it turns people against migrants and they start suspecting their neighbors.
So that's right.
This is the main cause for instability. One person does something, we start looking sideways at our Muslim neighbor, at our Chinese neighbor, at our African neighbor, because somehow he might be different than us.
What do they think of you? I mean, here you are, a white guy, you come into their area, into their town. I mean, do they Do they welcome you in open arms, or are they a little hesitant about you?
No, I think most people, when I was in my 40s, you know, people would say, what the hell are you doing here? And I would get detained and whatever. Now people know who I am. And so I've been with most rebel groups, and they have an agenda, of course. They want to show the outside world what they're doing. They want to put on a good face. The only group that hasn't really embraced that idea is ISIS. And I've been with Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda is very straightforward about why they let me in. They said, well, 85% of what you write is true. And I said, the hell with you, 100% of what you write is true. And they said, well, 85% is better than most people. But ISIS deliberately terrorizes journalists because they don't want them understanding how they work, because they're essentially a criminal network. And this is something to remember, that if there's a legitimate political cause, they will invite journalists in to see, you know, the oppression, and they'll tell them all the things that they're fighting against. But if they're a criminal organization that relies on extortion and terror, there's nothing for journalists to see. You know, they basically would come away and say these guys are thugs, and they're basically leaning on the local population to make money. And see, that's the difference between ISIS and, let's say, Al-Qaeda.
Is ISIS like Spectre in the James Bond films?
You know, it's interesting, because you mentioned how Saddam soldiers were part of, you know, the insurgency.
Yeah.
The people that are most efficient at killing and brutalized people tend to be from police or military or intelligence organizations in third world countries. And they have networks, and they have teams and gangs. And, you know, what they found in Iraq is that the death squads were essentially the police, you know, the military units that went around and kidnapped people and tortured them and threw them in mass graves. And that's why when you saw ISIS in Iraq machine gunning, you know, hundreds of Shia soldiers, you know damn well these are former Ba'athists.
No question about it.
Yeah, this is why they don't want people inside their organization. And there's been two or three people that have been given dog and pony tours. And I spent a lot of time with the Taliban, and I can tell you that as soon as you let a journalist inside a rebel or a terrorist organization, they become understandable. ISIS wants to be opaque and sort of mysterious and scary.
Robert, you mentioned Al-Qaeda, and over the past week, Osama bin Laden's son has become very vocal, saying he's going to seek revenge on the death of his father. What's going on there?
Well, Al-Qaeda has to remain relevant, and what happened is that under Osama bin Laden, when he worked for the Saudi intelligence service in the 80s in Peshawar, he was essentially funneling private donations, zakat funds, and money into supporting Arab-speaking jihadis that were then sent in to fight against the Russians. And as you remember, we paid the same amount of money. I think we paid $3 billion, and the Saudis paid another $3 billion. That money stuck to a lot of fingers, and it created Al-Qaeda as sort of a shock force for Wahhabism or fundamentalism Islam. Now, Al-Qaeda has been running out of money because people like to back a horse that's winning. And ISIS has diverted a lot of the funds that would normally go to Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is sort of on the back burner. So they don't really have a leader. They have this cranky old Dr. Zawahiri.
Who's still out there somewhere. Jeez.
He's out there in Miram Shah. Yeah, he still lives in Pakistan, and he still sends out audio recordings like it's 1972 or something.
Doesn't he know the world's gone digital?
Well, not only that, but some of the ISIS videos are just as good as any rock video.
Commercial
production.
They must have a production company somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Al-Qaeda had a production company in Miram Shah, but they did those kind of blurry, finger-wagging things against a backdrop. ISIS has hired video producers to do very slick things. They've done magazines, they've done short videos, they've done long form. And they've used that medium to get the attention of young people who are watching the internet, essentially, and sharing things on phones.
That's right.
So what's happening is Al-Qaeda is your grandfather's terrorist organization. And they're not winning, they're not doing anything. And at the end of the day, neither of these organizations, ISIS or Al-Qaeda, are anything other than shock troops for Sunni fundamentalists. And at some point, they're going to run out of money, because as you know, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, where a lot of these donors live, are now fighting their own wars in places like Yemen and Libya and other mm-hmm. places. So they're starting to reap the seeds that they sowed.
So Al-Qaeda's like the MySpace of the digital world now. They're kind of passé.
Yeah, you're just not cool if you're a member of Al-Qaeda.
Interesting take.
You're right.
Will we try to take out the son, Bin Laden's son, or will we just ignore him?
No, if he's pushed forward as a member of Al-Qaeda, he's automatically on somebody's HVT list. And I'm sure there's plenty of people that would do a high five after they do a drone hit. I mean, we yeah. regularly kill dozens and dozens of people in Pakistan. And it's actually a very easy place to find people now, because the Pakistanis have realized that they've also poisoned their own country with supporting these groups. Would we take him out if he just sat there and became sort of a long-winded, you know, speaker for Al-Qaeda? Probably not, but... I'm sure people would enjoy taking out the seed of Bin Laden.
Well, with Robert Young Pelton, of course, noted author to one of his books, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror. What about this guy who heads up ISIS, Robert, this Baghdadi guy? Can we get to him?
You know, it's funny. We never seem to find the number one guy. And the number one guy is usually protected in a cloak of non-digital obscurity. So they know that they can't stay near any type of electronic device or any kind of digital. They can't even stay where there's alternating current, because we can tap into that and we can listen through window panes, electrical circuits. So yeah, they're basically living in a safe house using couriers with little notes that run back and forth, which is how we got his predecessor.
That's right.
But the thing people have to remember is that these are not linear organizations where there's one guy at the top. I mean, all Islamic terrorist groups are run by shuras, whether it's the Taliban or the Haqqani network or whatever. They appoint a leader based on his popularity, and when that guy gets taken out, they just elect another person. That's why there's so many number twos, because the structure is... There's a shura, a group of people that could be anywhere from 5 to 12 people who make the major decisions, and then they elect this poor bugger to get droned at some point, and that's why they survive.
They say that Saddam Hussein, Robert, had billions, Gaddafi had billions, Yasser Arafat had billions all tucked away. What about the folks who apparently head up ISIS? Are they getting rich personally on this?
Yes, they would have to use middlemen in the banking and investment system. So, for example, a guy like Yasser Arafat, who skimmed off billions, I mean, of dollars of aid that was supposed to go to his people, would then reroute that through business people who would set up telecom networks or invest in major infrastructure and turn a profit. Now, you remember Bin Laden moved to Sudan in the 90s to start a construction company, and he bought farms mm-hmm. and he invested money, ideally to generate money. So ISIS, I'm very sure, has middlemen who are sort of nameless, faceless people who live in either the UAE or one of these, business-friendly locations that moves their money into standard investments.
I would guess that some of these leaders are probably saying, I'm not going to do this forever, so when I'm done, I want to live a great, comfortable life.
No, I don't think so. Once you take the step of being the leader of a thrill kill cult,
you're in it for good, huh?
Standing. Yeah, and this is something that anybody who leads a terrorist organization that comes out of the shura and then takes the number one slot has essentially marked himself for death. And that's a very interesting position to be in. It's like being a rock star. You know you're going to leave a good looking corpse. So this is the whole idea, is to create this sort of sense that death is good, and being taken out by a drone is somehow martyrdom. But there'll be another one and another one.
So I'll ask you the controversial question, and that is, if we weren't involved in all these countries, if we weren't bombing, if we weren't killing innocent people because collateral damage is occurring, you know, men, women, children that have nothing to do with any of this are dying and bombings and things like that. If we didn't do any of this, if we just merely never got into this, would there be terrorism on our grounds? Would they hate us as much as they do today?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's something that if you take a snapshot and you pretend it's 1985, do you remember we had Afghan freedom fighters visiting the White House talking to Ronald Reagan?
Yes, I sure do.
We had people praising the brave Afghans. Well, these are the Taliban.
That's the Taliban. That's right.
So when we went into these countries, we started with the best of intentions, with no rancor towards the actual people or their religion or their ethnicity. And as those people reminded us that freedom is basically, thanks, I'll take it from here, we began to micromanage their country under the guise that, oh, we broke it, we own it. And this is a very, very stupid thing to do. You know, freedom is the ability to get along and do your thing. We also installed governments that were made out of all kinds of weird and strange people that had nothing to do with the popular vote or interest of the people involved. So we brought in a lot of weirdos like Karzai and various, you know, Shia rulers of Baghdad who were not popular at all, but yet then became lining their pockets and hiring their friends to rape the country. So the answer to your question is we did it right once when we supported people to overthrow their government, whatever you may call it. We stayed away from the politics, from the religion, from the opinions, and we screwed up. We just stopped funding them and we moved on. Now, that then created blowback, which is then creating horrible rebel groups that then went after the natural resources of the country. You remember Joseph Savimbi in Angola went after the diamond mines and was able to fund his own rebellion, air quotes, until he was taken out by the Israelis. In Afghanistan, we created a monster called Karzai, which he's a nice guy, but he hired every single major government official who then began lining their pockets. So we alienated ourselves. I would do a reboot. I would basically say, what affects an American and what is our foreign policy and how should we use our force? I don't necessarily agree with President Obama's use of proxies because it gets you into a very Byzantine problem on the next step. But I don't think we should be as aggressive in countries like Yemen or whatever that have zero impact on our well-being and safety.
That's right. In a perfect world, if there were no wars, would there still be conflict from those who are trying to position themselves and gain from wars? And I guess by that I mean, special interest groups.
Well, let's do this. Let's redefine war. For example, we're at war with the Chinese right now. Now, are there bullets flying? No. Are there troops, marching? No. But electronically, the Chinese are insidiously attacking our businesses, our intellectual property,
yes,
our government bases. We will not fire a shot because we've got so much financial interest in China, but we are at war. So what we have to rethink is that right now there are no old-fashioned wars. If you think of the Somme, if you think of D-Day, there's no real wars on Earth today. But what there are, low-intensity conflicts, insurgencies, criminal groups, gangs, whatever. So we have to stop and say, what is a war and should America get involved? Because does it actually create a threat to us if we're involved in an unjust war by backing a brutal proxy? And I think that's really the question is, are these police actions or are these reason to send U.S. troops? Now, I'll back that up by saying that if we had a draft and if going into a war affected every single family, you would have a very, very different foreign policy around here.
Yeah, we sure would. Stay with us, Robert. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and take phone calls with you as we talk about the world in chaos. Robert Young Pelton with us, and of course, his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. A couple other books that he has written called The World's Most Dangerous Places and also Come Back Alive. Don't forget, talking about technology, Do like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, and we shall be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.